Welcome to That Was Radio, where we explore all aspects of the golden age of radio. Not just the radio programs themselves, but also the personalities and events that shaped those programs. I'm Leon Smothers for WMKY, Morehead State Public Radio. As you may have guessed from the opening, this episode is about Westerns. We'll be looking at all sorts of Westerns on this program. Westerns for kids, Westerns for adults, Westerns for the whole family. I'll even throw in some discussion of singing cowboys. Near the end, I will especially want to discuss the program Gunsmoke and its star William Conrad. From the earliest days of U.S. history, the frontier was fascinating to Americans. To the folks and settlements back east, the West was a place of danger and adventure, and they loved to hear the tales of the daring men and women who were settling this wild country. Tales of Davy Crockett at the Alamo, tales of Kit Carson and the Indian campaigns, tales of the 49ers and the easy fortunes to be made in the gold fields. As has always been the case, they were especially interested in stories that made the heroes larger than life, the types of stories where a lone hero undertakes some noble quest or arrives in the nick of time to save the day. In the most popular stories, the hero would, of course, perform some incredible feats of strength and courage, saving a child from ferocious animals, staving off an Indian attack, or bringing a band of outlaws to justice. In order to provide a worthy opponent for such a hero, it was necessary, as you might guess, to have correspondingly infamous villains. Mountain lions and grizzly bears must be the largest and fiercest sort. The Indians and outlaws of the Old West were the most vicious and bloodthirsty of villains. I'm exaggerating, of course, but not by much. At first, these stories were strictly just spread orally. In the early frontier days, books were relatively expensive and difficult to obtain, but around the time of the Civil War, publishers began turning out cheaply made books referred to as dime novels. The stories here were certainly not critically acclaimed, and the writing was often formulaic, but the dime novels resonated with American readers and became immensely popular. Although the subject matter of dime novels varied, it was the Western that was most popular. I find it fascinating that, as far-fetched and unrealistic as the tales of the frontier were, many of the popular songs of the period seem to reflect the experiences and attitudes of real men and women who were settling the frontier. The song "Green Grow the Lilacs" was extremely popular with soldiers during the Mexican War. This may have been in part due to the reference to the colors of the flag in the lyrics. There is a story that the early settlers in South Texas sang this song so much that the Mexicans across the border, who couldn't speak English, began calling Americans gringos, which is how they heard the first words of the song. For those of you not familiar with the song, here is Ed McCurdy's version from 1956.
Green grow the lilacs all sparkling with dew. I'm lonely, my darling, since parting with you. But by our next meeting I hope to prove true and change the green lilacs to the red, white, and blue. I once had a sweetheart, but now I have none. Since she's gone and left me, I care not for one. Since she's gone and left me, contented I'll be, for she loves another one better than me. Green grow the lilacs all sparkling with dew. I'm lonely, my darling, since parting with you. But by our next meeting I hope to prove true and change the green lilacs to the red, white, and blue. Thank you. I wrote my love letters in rosy red lines. She sent me an answer all twisted in twines, saying, keep your love letters and I will keep mine. You write to your love and I'll write to mine. Green grow the lilacs all sparkling with dew. I'm lonely, my darling, since parting with you. But by our next meeting I hope to prove true and change the green lilacs to the red, white, and blue.
That was Ed McCurdy singing Green Grow the Lilacs. Other songs from the frontier period, such as Shenandoah and Bury Me Not on the Lone Prairie, expressed the loneliness and sadness people on the frontier felt at being separated from family and loved ones back east. Others, such as Streets of Laredo, confront the tragedy associated with the violent deaths of young people. Sweet Betsy from Pike tells the story of a couple from eastern Kentucky and their perilous and desolate journey to the cold fields of California. Although the songs may have conveyed a more realistic impression of the Old West, it was the tales of adventure and daring that provided the seed material for the earliest motion pictures. Edwin Porter's The Great Train Robbery, filmed in 1903, includes many of the elements of the classic Western, especially lots of gunfire and a chase scene. This was an extremely popular movie and considered by many to be the best until D.W. Griffith's The Birth of a Nation 12 years later. By 1913, more than 50 silent westerns had been made. By 1930, when radio was just coming into its own, western movies with sound were both plentiful and popular. Especially plentiful were the B-westerns, which were so very popular with youngsters. It was only natural then that during its early years, radio would turn to westerns for source material. Many of the early westerns on radio were written for children and used the same plot devices they would have seen in the movies. In fact, one of the first western programs was not only for kids, it was about a kid cowboy named Bobby Benson. This show had two incarnations separated by a gap of 13 years. The first run was from 1932 through 1936, and the second 1949 through 1955. This gives the Benson Show the distinction of being both one of the first and one of the last of the juvenile dramas on network radio. As was the case with many of the early radio programs, this one was created by a program struggling during the early years of the Great Depression. The company was the Hecker H.O. Company of Buffalo, New York, makers of breakfast cereals. In 1932, Hecker representatives met with Herbert Rice of the Buffalo Broadcasting Corporation with an offer to sponsor a children's adventure series as a means of promoting their products. Herb Rice had been born in England and moved to the U.S. when he was 19. By the age of 25, he was working with the CBS affiliate in Buffalo as an actor, writer, director, and salesman. He proved to be extremely adept at creating shows and discovering talent. By 1932, he had already created several dramatic series for local radio stations. Rice developed a story about a preteen orphan named Bobby Benson, who inherits a ranch in the Big Bend area of South Texas. The ranch was called the H Bar O, reflecting the sponsor's name. Apart from Bobby, the primary characters were Bobby's guardian, Sonny Jim, and the ranch foreman, Buck Mason. The official name of the original series was the H Bar O Rangers, but it was known to fans and listed in newspapers simply as The Bobby Benson Show. The program was set in the present day rather than the Old West. There are few details available about the first series, but many of the plots had Bobby and his friends combating rustlers, smugglers, and bandits, just as they would have in the Old West. But the show included some unusual plot elements as well, such as Bobby flying with some of his friends on a trip around the world. For the first year, the series was broadcast from the CBS affiliate in Buffalo, and all the parts were played by local actors. including Rice and his wife. The response to the program's debut was so overwhelming that Hecker H. O. had to hire a staff of 12 people to answer the letters and sort the premium responses. After the first season, CBS radio executives decided to move the broadcasts to Manhattan with a new cast and some role changes. The new Bobby was Billy Hallop, who later appeared in many movies with the Dead End Kids. One of the other parts was played by well-known cowboy actor Tex Ritter. Hallop was treated as a star during his stint as Bobby. His photo was used in promotional material for the program, and he appeared in full Western gear on a Pinto pony in numerous personal appearances. Although the first series of Bobby Benson ended in December of 1936, Herb Rice always kept the show in the back of his mind, and in 1949, after he had become a vice president at Mutual Broadcasting, he was able to convince the network to put the program back on the air. Since Hecker was no longer sponsoring, Rice called this version of the show Bobby Benson and the B-Bar-B Riders.
Here they come, they're riding fast and they're riding hard. It's time for excitement and adventure in the West with Bobby Benson and the B-Bar-B Riders.
B-Bar-B!
Now for today's exciting story, The Queen of the Cowgirl.
You're listening to That Was Radio on Moorhead State Public Radio. I'm Leon Smothers for WMKY 90.3 FM. The new series was also modified to have fewer characters. Buck Mason became Tex Mason, and Bobby got a new horse, a golden palomino named Amigo. For most of this run, Bobby was played by Clive Rice, Herb's nephew, performing under the stage name of Clyde Campbell. One of the new characters was an old geezer named Windy Wales, played by Don Knotts. Knotts, who would later gain notoriety for his role on The Andy Griffith Show, was only in his 20s at the time. The B-Bar-B Riders aired from June of 1949 through June 1955, and this show was just as popular as the first. This was due in large part to Rice's promotional efforts. As before, Rice pushed personal appearances. Various Bobbies appeared in costume for a 10-state tour and at such venues as the Pony Express Rodeo, Macy's Thanksgiving Parade, and the Ringling Brothers Circus. Rice was also a master of merchandising. More than 40 different B-Bar-B products were sold in hundreds of stores nationwide, including bicycles, pistol sets, various clothing, and comic books. There is little left today of the Bobby Benson legacy other than premiums. The total number of broadcasts for the two series was over 1,000 episodes. Of these, none of the CBS episodes and only 19 of the Mutual episodes still exist. In addition, there are 5 5-minute episodes of a spinoff called Songs of the B-Bar-B, and there is also a 7-minute adventure on record. Another of the early radio westerns for kids featured a popular early matinee cowboy, Tom Mix. At least it featured his name. The Tom Mix Ralston Straight Shooters was created by Charles Claggett, who worked for an advertising agency in St. Louis. The agency had recently lost the account for the Ralston Purina Company, and Claggett was working to get it back. He found out by talking to area school children that their favorite hero was Tom Mix. The company obtained Mix's authorization to use his name in advertising and to impersonate him on radio. Mix himself never appeared on the show. Claggett put together ideas for a program and demonstrated to Ralston how popular Mix was with children. Ralston liked what they heard and went on to sponsor the program for its entire run. The show was broadcast on NBC 3 times a week beginning in September of 1933. Then it was dropped for one season during World War II. When it was ready to return, there was no slot available on NBC, so the program moved to Mutual, where it was heard daily until 1949, and then again 3 days a week until it ended in 1950. The show Claggett developed was based loosely, at first, on the life of the real Tom Mix. Mix had been a cowboy, a deputy sheriff, and a rodeo performer before making movies. He had the looks, physical strength, and riding skills to stand out as a movie cowboy, and soon became a star. Mix made more than 300 movies. Most of them were silents. The Tom Mix character on the radio program was a cowboy detective living on the TM Bar Ranch near Dobie, Texas, with his wonder horse Tony, his two adopted children, Jane and Jimmy, and his elderly sidekick, originally called the Old Wrangler and later Mike Shaw. Youngsters loved the program, which provided tales of mystery and adventure with lots of humor interspersed. There was very little violence or cruelty. Tom seldom injured or killed anyone. When necessary, he would shoot the gun out of the bad guy's hand or crease his skull with a bullet. When the program moved to Mutual, it was put in a slot opposite the very popular Dick Tracy show and had some problem pulling listeners. To solve this problem, Claggett took a very direct approach. He hired the writer, George Lowther, away from the Tracy program. Lowther was an exceptional writer, but as many who remember the program have commented, the shows he wrote were not particularly Western. In various episodes, Tom and his friends were pitted against bad guys who were attempting such nefarious deeds as bombing a power plant, stealing radioactive material, selling military secrets to enemy agents, and smuggling stuff across the Mexican border. Also, over the years, Tom had to battle an inordinate number of invisible men. The part of Tom Mix was played by several different actors, but Curly Bradley was in the role the longest. Bradley had begun his professional career as a stuntman in the movies, including some movies with the real Tom Mix. And before taking on the lead role, he had been on the program playing another principal character called Pecos. Bradley had a very nice voice, and among other duties, sang the Ralston jingle.
The Tom Mix Ralston Street Shooters are on the air. And here comes Tom Mix, America's favorite cowboy.
Tony, come on, boy.
Dread it, Ralston, for your breakfast. Start the day all shining bright. Gives you lots of cowboy energy with a flavor that's just right. It's delicious and nutritious, bite-sized and ready to eat. Take a sip from Tongo and let your mom spit it Ralston, change me, be.
Comics, Ralston, Street Shooters bring you another episode in the mystery of the Scarlet Scarecrow.
Who is the Scarlet Scarecrow? Even more important, as Tom Mix's returning strength enabled him at last to break through the hypnotic spell cast over him by this amazing trickster, the answers to those questions are revealed in a startling and dramatic way.
The Tom Mix character was not only on radio. His thrilling tales were also carried in books, comic books, and a weekly Sunday comic strip. All of these frequently tied Tom's adventures to premiums that were available for a Ralston box top and a dime. While most juvenile dramas offered premiums, Tom Mix was, in his day, the leader of the pack. Around 150 premium items were offered during the radio years and after. Guns, books, badges, buttons, belts, chaps, hats, shirts, lots of rings, and many more. As with the Bobby Benson program, only a few episodes remain, in this case 27. It is sad to realize most of the stories from these once extremely popular radio programs now exist only in the ever-fading memory of aging fans. You're listening to That Was Radio on Moorhead State Public Radio. I'm Leon Smothers for WMKY 90.3 FM. The life of a working cowboy was tedious and tiring. Long hours on horseback, riding, roping, branding, and mending fences. So at the end of the day, they would sit in the bunkhouse or around a campfire and entertain each other with jokes, tall stories, and songs. Some modern critics poke fun at the singing cowboys, but they were a legitimate part of the Old West. Two of the most popular of the radio singing cowboys, Gene Autry and Roy Rogers, were also two of the most popular movie and later TV cowboys. Gene Autry was raised in Texas and Oklahoma. In 1929, when he was only 22, he began his career on radio at station KVOO in Tulsa, where he was billed as Oklahoma's Yodeling Cowboy. In 1929, he began performing on the National Barn Dance for radio station WLS in Chicago. Between 1934 and 1953, he and his horse Champion appeared in 93 feature films. His radio program, Gene Autry's Melody Ranch, ran from 1940 to 1956 on CBS. Throughout the run, the show was sponsored by Double Mint Gum. On each show, Gene would sing several songs, and Pat Buttram, one of Autry's longtime associates, would tell a humorous story. Then about half of the program would be devoted to some tale of adventure. The most incredible thing about Gene Autry was his recording career. He made more than 600 recordings with total sales of over 100 million copies. Seven of his records went gold, and two went platinum. He is especially known for his Christmas recordings of Here Comes Santa Claus and Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, the latter of which is the second all-time best-selling Christmas single, with sales in excess of 30 million copies. Autry also wrote or co-wrote more than 300 songs. Here is Gene in a 1939 recording of his theme song, Back in the Saddle Again.
I'm back in the saddle again, out where a friend is a friend, where the longhorn cattle feed on the lowly gypsum wheat. Back in the saddle again, riding the range once more, toting my old 44, where you sleep out every night and the only law is right. Back in the saddle again. Whoopee-tie-i-o, rocking to and fro, back in the saddle again. Whoopee-tie-i-yay, I go my way, back in the saddle again. I'm back in the saddle again, out where a friend is a friend, where the longhorn cattle feed on the lonely jimson weed. Back in the saddle again, riding the range once more, toting my old 44, where you sleep out every night and the only law is right. Back in the saddle again. Whoopee-tie-i-o, rocking to and fro, back in the saddle again. Whoopee-tie-i-yay, I go my way, back in the saddle again.
That was Gene Autry singing Back in the Saddle Again. Roy Rogers was another of the great singing cowboys. Originally named Leonard Sly, he was born and grew up in southern Ohio. At age 18, he moved to California, where he worked as a truck driver and picked fruit in California's Central Valley. He began his singing career by entering an amateur contest on a Los Angeles radio station. Within a few years, he had received some recognition for his talent and formed a cowboy music group called the Sons of the Pioneers. In 1934, the group had a big hit with the song Tumbling Tumbleweeds. Leonard made his first film appearance in 1935 and worked steadily as a supporting actor in westerns. In 1938, when Gene Autry temporarily walked out of his movie contract, Republic Pictures turned to Leonard and changed his name to Roy Rogers. Handsome, athletic, and riding Trigger, the best-looking horse in the movies, he quickly became a matinee idol and a major box office attraction. He was listed as one of the top 10 money-making Western stars for 15 consecutive years and held first place in that category from 1943 to 1954, earning him the title King of the Cowboys. After 1944, Rogers had something no other movie cowboy had, a leading lady who could ride and shoot and sing right along with him. That was the year he and Dale Evans made their first movie together. They made 27 more, and, oh yeah, they got married in December of 1947. The Roy Rogers radio program was first broadcast in 1944 on the Mutual Network and alternated between there and NBC with a variety of sponsors during the next decade. The format of the Rogers Show varied through the years, but most of the programs were devoted to the storyline, generally with only one or two songs. Often they would end with Happy Trails to You, which was written by Dale Evans. You're listening to That Was Radio on WMKY 90.3 FM. I'm Leon Smothers. By far the most popular radio western for modern listeners is The Lone Ranger. Created by George W. Trendle and writer Fran Stryker, the program first aired at the end of January 1933 on station WXYZ in Detroit. Earl Grosser was the first voice of the Ranger from May of 1933 until his death in April 1941. Afterward, Brace Beamer, who had been the show's announcer for several years, took over the role and played the part until the series ended in September 1954. Let's listen to the opening of a program that aired in June of 1948 and told the story of the origin of the Lone Ranger.
Horse with the speed of light, a cloud of dust, and a hearty Hi-Yo Silver, the Lone Ranger. This is the legend of a man who buried his identity to dedicate his life to the service of humanity and country. It is the story of the origin of the Lone Ranger. Early settlers in the West had to be brave men and women, ready to fight for their lives at any moment. There was danger on every side. There were wild beasts, savage Indians, and the Cavendish Gang. Butch Cavendish headed a pack of outlaws. They struck without warning to steal and kill.
Open fire on that wagon train! Wipe them out to the last man!
The Cavendish gang attacked ranches and towns as well as wagon trains. Everyone feared Butch Cavendish. His gang grew rich and powerful. Finally, the Texas Rangers learned where Butch Cavendish and his gang were hiding. 6 Texas Rangers guided their horses along a canyon floor to arrest the Cavendish gang. Presently, Captain Reed signaled a halt.
Right in, boys. We'll wait here until a scout returns.
You think it was a good idea to send Collins, our guide, on ahead?
It was Captain Reed's younger brother who asked the question. The captain explained that Collins, who was not a Texas Ranger, was the only man who knew the country and who could scout ahead for information. Then, while the Texas Rangers waited for the guide's return, the captain said to his younger brother,
My wife and son are coming from the east. If something happens to me, and you survive, well, I know you'll take care of her and Danny.
Right.
I'm going to count on you to resign from the Rangers and work that silver mine we staked out. See that my son and his mother get my share.
I promise.
Here comes Collins, the scout.
Silly.
What's the word, Collins?
Good news, Captain Reed. It's all clear. I scouted the rim on both sides of the canyon and found no sign of the Cavendish outfit.
All right, boys, let's go. Get up there.
Get up. Come on.
Collins, the guide, lagged behind unnoticed by the Texas Rangers, who moved in single file along the floor of the rock-strewn canyon. They didn't know that Collins had lied, that Butch Cavendish and his killers were waiting in ambush on the rim on both sides of the gap.
Here come those Rangers, boys, just as Collins told us.
Yeah, they are.
Now, we can't get down to the floor of the canyon without going a long way back, and it'll be dark in half an hour. So we'll just keep pouring lead into them from up here until we're sure they're dead. Then we won't be taking any chances. Now open fire!
The Rangers leap from their saddles and spread out as they return the fire from both sides of the canyon. Soon, four of the Rangers were killed. Captain Dan Reed and his brother, wounded several times, kept fighting side by side. Then the captain fell, mortally wounded, and a moment later, his younger brother, the last of the Rangers, slumped to the ground.
The Indian Tonto found the seriously wounded Reed and nursed him back to health. When the Indian buried the dead Rangers, he made six graves, disguising the fact that one Ranger had survived. Reed, whose first name is never revealed, eventually recovered. Then he put on a mask and, along with Tonto, began a campaign to avenge the death of his brother and fellow Rangers and to bring peace and justice to the West. The Lone Ranger was distinctive from other cowboy heroes in a number of ways. Obviously, wearing a mask is one way, but he also owned a silver mine that provided him an endless source of silver bullets and unlimited income. It also allowed him to have silver shoes on his great white stallion named, appropriately enough, Silver. He also differed from typical cowboy heroes because he never shot to kill. And while many of the radio cowboys had sidekicks, his was an Indian. Tonto was played for the entire run by John Todd. Many fans of the program would argue that indeed Tonto was not a sidekick, but a co-hero. Whenever the Lone Ranger was captured or injured, Tonto proved perfectly capable of coping with the situation. We are fortunate that a great number of Lone Ranger episodes exist, covering the entire duration of the program. The stories provide evidence of Fran Stryker's ingenuity at continually putting the masked hero into perilous situations and resolving them with no one getting killed.
Around Dodge City and in the territory on West, there's just one way to handle the killers and the spoilers, and that's with a U.S. Marshal and the smell of gun smoke. Gunsmoke, starring William Conrad. The story of the violence that moved west with young America. And the story of a man who moved with it.
I'm that man. Matt Dillon, United States Marshal. The first man they look for and the last they want to meet. It's a chancy job, and it makes a man watchful. And a little lonely.
You're listening to That Was Radio on Morehead State Public Radio. I'm Leon Smothers for WMKY 90.3 FM. Another program that is very popular with current audiences is Gunsmoke. The program first aired on April 26, 1952, by which time many popular radio shows had made the jump to television. Radio and Western fans, both then and now, think that everything about Gunsmoke was first rate. The acting, the writing, the music, even the sound effects. The creation of the program itself resulted from the convergence of multiple independent circumstances. Producer Norman McDonald and writer John Meston had been developing ideas for an adult Western since about 1949. Then over at CBS in 1951, President William Paley suggested that the network develop a dramatic series along the lines of a tough guy detective transported to the Old West. So in April of 1952, when one of the CBS programs was about to lose its sponsor and therefore its time slot, everything fell into place. Within a week's time, CBS had a script, a cast, and even a theme song. And it was an immediate hit with listeners. Gunsmoke was set in the railhead town of Dodge City, Kansas, sometime during the great cattle drives of the 1870s and 80s. Some of the stories involved violence and sexual issues that weren't heard on other radio westerns of the era, things such as massacres, scalping, incest, and rape. Many episodes ended tragically. The program attempted to show that, in the Old West, defeat, sorrow, and brutality went hand in hand with justice, humor, and hope. So recurring themes included man's inhumanity to man, the certainty of life's problems, and the difficulty women faced on the frontier. In order to address this last point, Gunsmoke hired women writers to develop stories with a female slant. There were four primary characters on the program. Matt Dillon was a United States Marshal with the thankless job of keeping law and order in a rough and rugged town. He was portrayed as a complex and flawed man, doing the best he could under difficult circumstances. Often those circumstances were kill or be killed. The other primary characters were Chester Proudfoot, Matt's simple but loyal deputy, Doc Adams, the town's only doctor, and Kitty Russell, the owner and manager of the local saloon. The following is an edited episode of Gunsmoke entitled Word of Honor, in which Doc Adams has been captured by outlaws. They take him to their hideout to tend to a wounded hostage. Doc removes the bullet, but the young man dies anyway. The outlaws allow Doc to leave after he gives his word that he won't reveal who they are or where they're hiding. We enter the action just after Doc has told Marshal Dillon what happened, but keeping his word, he hasn't revealed who the outlaws are.
How are we ever going to find them, Mr. Dillon?
I don't know, Chester. We don't even know who they killed.
Funny, we haven't heard about it.
Maybe nobody's missed him yet.
Just think. Doc could lead us straight to him right now.
Well, it isn't making the Doc happy, Chester.
No, sir, it sure isn't.
Here, Chester, take these letters down to the depot for me, will you? They got to be in Washington next week.
Santa Fe pulls out in an hour, sir. I'll put them right in the mail car.
Why, Jake Worth, why, you haven't come into Dodge in the last 6 months that I know of.
I'm here now, Marshal.
Oh? Trouble, Jake?
I'd call it that.
Well?
You know that cottonwood, the big one down at Brandy Bend?
Yeah.
There's a hole cut down by the roots at the north side of it. I put a sack in that hole this morning. It's got $20,000 in it.
That's a lot of money, Jake, even for you.
It isn't if Hank gets back all right.
Hank? That's your youngest boy, isn't it, Jake?
Yeah, 18 last month.
Yeah. And that's ransom money. Your boy's been kidnapped, huh?
He didn't show up the other night, Marshal. Next morning, I found a note tacked on the corral. Said to leave the money or they'd kill him.
Oh, come on, Jake. We'll try to get there before they pick up the money.
No, Marshal, I won't take any chances. They'd shoot him sure if we did that.
You should have told me before you left the money. You should have come here first, you know?
You didn't hear what I said, Marshal. I won't take the chance. All I want now is for you to watch for anybody who turns up rich around here.
Jake, I want you to listen to me.
Now, you listen to me, Marshal. Nobody is going to do a thing till Hank's back safe on the ranch. Not one dang thing.
Jake, if they killed Hank, you'd want him hung, wouldn't you?
I'll hang him myself if it comes to that. I'll hunt him down like wolves.
All right, then let's go. Let's get on to Brandy Bend and wait for him.
No. I already told you no.
Hank's dead, Jake.
Huh?
They already shot him. And he's dead.
What are you talking about? Where is he?
I don't know.
And how come you know he's dead?
I can't tell you.
Marshal, I've had about enough of this.
We're wasting time here. Come on, Jake. I'll tell you what I can on the way to the river.
You better, by heaven, or one of us ain't never going to get to the river.
Jake Worth was known as a hard, hot-tempered man, but he was straight as they come. He'd made one fortune in Texas cattle and another in buffalo hides, and now all he wanted was his ranch and his three sons to work it with him. The Worths were good men. They didn't cause any trouble, and they worked hard. It was hard to tell Jake, but without mentioning Doc, I said what I could. And when we reached the Arkansas, we hid our horses in the clump of bush and worked our way on foot up to the big cottonwood. Then I stood up and walked out into the open.
What are you doing, Marshal? You gone crazy?
Come on, Jake. No use to hide now.
Oh. That's him there, isn't it? That's Hank?
I'm afraid so, Jake.
And they killed him. They killed him, all right. He was a good boy. Had his whole life to live yet. Why'd they do it? I gave him the money. Why'd they do it?
I'm sorry, Jake.
Marshal, I've been kind of confused by all this. I swallowed your story on the way down here. But I want the truth now. Every bit of it.
That's all I know, Jake. Hank tried to break and one of them shot him. But we'll get him.
I'll take care of myself as soon as you tell me who they are.
I don't know who they are.
Don't lie to me, Marshal. You know a lot you're not telling me. What's going on with you anyway?
I've told you all I can,
Jake. That's my boy lying there, Marshal. He's been murdered. And if I didn't know you so well, I'd begin to think maybe you had something to do with it yourself.
Now, just a minute, Jake. I know you're upset.
Then why don't you tell me?
Because the man who told me about it had to promise not to name anybody, that's why.
What man? Who is he? I'll get it out of him if I have to cut it out.
Yeah, I know. That's why I can't tell you who he is.
What kind of a lawman are you, anyway?
I've told you all I can, Jake.
No. No, you haven't. Marshal, I don't believe your story about nobody. Promise nothing. You know who done it. And you're going to tell me or
don't
I'm...
Don't try it, Jake. You can't kill me, and you know it.
Nope. I can't. Me and my boys can. And I'm giving you 24 hours to name those men, and then we're coming to Dodge. There'll be blood spilt, Marshal.
Jake, I give you my word, I don't know who did it.
I don't believe you.
I'll help you take your boy home now.
Go on back to Dodge. I'll manage here.
You're making a bad mistake, Jake.
24 hours, Marshal.
I'll be there.
We'll find you wherever you be.
Jake, I want... So long, Jake. There was no use arguing with him. The man's grief had destroyed his reason. And the worst of it was, I knew his sons would do whatever Jake told them to do. Unless I could stop it somehow, I'd have to shoot it out with three good and perfectly innocent men. For no reason at all. I thought about it all the way back to Dodge, and by the time I got there, I had an idea. I went up to Doc's and talked it over with him.
All right, Matt. I'll do whatever I can.
It might not work, Doc, and you'll be exposing yourself to a lot of danger. Have you thought about that?
I have. I've also been thinking about the men who killed Hank Worth.
Well, we could wait till they start spending their money, or till one of them gets drunk and maybe talks too much somewhere.
We could, but meantime you and the Worths will have a gunfight. Oh, Matt, it'd be a terrible thing to let happen.
All right, then, Doc, let's go. I want to get to the ranch before dark.
Yeah, maybe Jake's cooled off by now. Enough not to start shooting on sight, anyway.
Yeah, we'll soon find out. Come on.
You're listening to an episode of Gunsmoke that aired on January the 10th, 1953. This is Morehead State Public Radio, WMKY, 90.3 FM.
That's far enough, Marshal. Watch him, boys.
If he makes a move, shoot.
Yes, fine.
Jake, I came here to stop a shooting, not to start one.
You can stop it, Marshal. Just tell me who killed my son.
If I knew, I'd be on his trail, Jake.
I'm not sure of that at all. What's Doc doing here?
Tell him, Doc.
I took the bullet out of Hank. He died soon after.
What?
That's right, Jake. Now come down here where we can talk like friends, and I'll explain it to you.
Stay where you are, boys.
Yes. All right.
All right, Doc, let's hear it.
Well, they got me out of bed, Jake, and they led me out into the country. Hank had been shot in the back, and I extracted the bullet, but it was no use. He'd have died anyway. There were three men there, and I recognized one of them.
Who was he?
Well, I had to promise I wouldn't tell, Jake, or they'd have killed me.
That don't matter
now. Think about it a minute, Jake. Doc gave him his word, and you're asking him to break it. Now, think about it for a minute.
I'm thinking. Thinking about my boy, too.
Hank's dead. You can't help him now.
Shot in the back, and the coward who did it's running free.
You want to help get him, Jake?
Don't ask fool questions, Marshal. Of course I want to get him.
Then listen to me. Those men told Doc if he talked, they'd kill him.
Yeah, and they meant it, too.
All right, so I got an idea now, Jake. We'll spread it around that Doc has identified the killer. The news will reach him soon enough. In the meantime, I'm going to lay low. And I'll have Chester tell everybody that I've ridden out after them.
Go on.
Then we'll just wait. One or two or maybe all three of them will come into Dodge to kill Doc some night soon.
They still might get away.
And I'll deputize you and your boys right now, and you can wait for them with us. You'll have to stay hidden like me, of course.
We won't mind that. Not if we get a chance at them, we won't.
All right, good.
Yeah. Funny thing, though.
What?
A man like Doc here, rather than break his word, he'll make himself a target for those killers.
Yeah. Look, Jake, Doc and I are going to go back to Dodge now. I'll see that the story gets started, and in a day or two, you and your boys can ride in, but separately, though. Otherwise, it might cause talk.
I understand.
And come straight to Doc's.
We'll get there.
The next few days, Doc never left his office. I figured that'd make him look scared and draw the killers right into our trap. The rest of us sat around in his back room and waited. Chester kept us supplied with food and coffee, but we began to get pretty restless cooped up like that. And by the fifth night, we were being real careful with one another and over-polite. But on the sixth night, about midnight, we got our game.
Mr. Dillon, I think it's them.
I think it's where.
They just rode up Front Street, three of them. They're tying up outside right now. They acted too deliberate-like for ordinary riders, so I run up the back way to tell you.
Doc, come on in.
What do you want me to do, Matt?
Take cover in here and stay out of sight.
Yeah, whatever you say, Matt.
Let's go downstairs and meet them, Marshal.
No, we might just scatter them that way. Hmm. Now listen. One of them will probably stand guard on the street while the other two come up here to get Doc. Chester, you and the two boys go down the back way. Jake and I'll wait in the Doc's office. But don't jump that man while we go into action up here. Do you understand?
I got it.
All right, then move fast. Come on, Jake.
Now what?
Well, we'll just wait here in the dark.
Good.
I'll fix Doc's blanket on the couch here so they'll think he's in it.
They're on the stairs now.
All right, get back in the corner, Jake, or we'll be shooting each other.
Right.
Quiet now. And don't start shooting till I do.
Wake up, you lying dog.
Let you shoot him and get out of here.
What? Wait. He ain't here.
What?
Get your hands up. You're under arrest, both of you.
It's a trap.
You all right, Jake?
I got one of them. I'm all right.
Doc. Doc, you can come on out now.
All right, Matt.
They're dead. Light the lamp, will you, Doc?
All right. Yes, you bet, Matt. Light the lamp right here.
Okay, Mr. Dillon?
Yeah, come in, Chester.
Well, we got him, Mr. Dillon. He tried to get away when he heard you up here, but he ran smack into one of the Worth boys. He's dead.
Yeah. Well, I don't know either one of these men. Doc, you can tell us now. Is one of these the man you recognize?
Let me see here. This one here. I remembered later I treated him for a broken nose sometime back. I never did know his name, though. He came up on the, up the trail with a herd, I think.
That don't matter now, as long as they're all dead.
Oh, well. Bring the other bodies up, Chester. I'll do the autopsies quick, and I'll get them out of here. It's about time I got something out of all this.
Okay, Doc.
I'll fetch you.
Gunsmoke, under the direction of Norman MacDonald, stars William Conrad as Matt Dillon, U.S. Marshal. Tonight's story was specially written for Gunsmoke by John Meston, with music composed and conducted by Rex Corey. Featured in the cast were John Daner, with Lawrence Dobkin and Harry Bartell. Parley Bear is Chester, Howard McNear is Doc, and Georgia Ellis is Kitty. Join us again next week as Matt Dillon, U.S. Marshal, fights to bring law and order out of the wild violence of the West in Gunsmoke. This is Roy Rowan speaking over the CBS Radio Network.
Gunsmoke ran on radio until June 18, 1961, well into the television era. Radio's Gunsmoke was so well written that for the first 4 years of the television program, 90% of the scripts were just repeats from the radio broadcast. A large portion of the program's success was due to its star, William Conrad. Conrad was born in Louisville, Kentucky, but moved to Los Angeles when he was seven. After college, he became an announcer, director, and writer for radio station KMPC in Los Angeles. After serving in the Air Force during World War II, he became an actor with numerous roles in movies and television, as well as radio. He had one of the best voices in radio. Conrad estimated that during his radio career, he performed in over 7,500 program episodes. Steve Darnall wrote in Nostalgia Digest that Conrad turned up on radio more often than static. William Conrad died of a heart attack in 1994. He was elected to the Radio Hall of Fame in 1997. Now, to take us to the end of our program, here are Roy Rogers and Dale Evans singing Happy Trails.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then. Who cares about the clouds when we're together?
Just sing a song and drink the sunny weather.
Happy trails to you till we meet again. Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then. Happy trails to you till we meet again.
There were many other fine westerns broadcast in the golden age of radio that we don't have time to cover in this program. Death Valley Days, The Cisco Kid, Tales of Texas Rangers, Hopalong Cassidy, Fort Laramie, The Six Shooter, and many others. If you'd like to learn more about these or any other radio westerns, there are some excellent books by Jack French, Martin Grams Jr., and Jim Harmon. So, as the sun sets in the Old West, it's time to say, you've been listening to That Was Radio, where we discuss old-time radio programs and the people and events that shaped them. I'm Leon Smothers, and this is Moorhead State Public Radio, WMKY 90.3 FM.